Hey, it's Greg and Chuck in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Greg and Chuck, how are you?
We're doing fine. How about you?
Oh, I'm pretty darn good. I think it's illegal.
No. It can't be.
Really? Not even in Tulsa?
Well, maybe in Tulsa. You may have a point there.
I have a lot of good friends down there.
You do?
Yeah. Do you happen to know Tony Holden?
Yeah, sure do.
Tony Holden is the man that I hold responsible for moving me to Kansas.
You're kidding me.
No, he is a very, very good friend of mine. And as a matter of fact, I was just on the phone with him last night, just cursing his name.
Wow!
Yeah, he's a great guy.
I know him through Dale Paul Cook, and I also know him through some of the boxing stuff that he's done, promoted throughout the years here. So.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, it's when before he started doing the boxing promotion, but was still involved with Tommy.
Right.
He actually saw an ESPN special I did, and he was producing Championship Fishing.
Wow.
So he invited me out to Kansas City to do the show and work with him on it. And it just reminded me of California when California was neat. So we ended up moving here.
Wow, when California was neat. I like that.
That's too cool. You know, and it's kind of funny because it's so middle of the country.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm a guy that spent his entire life surfing and diving and fishing in the ocean. And I absolutely swore I would never live more than 10 minutes by bicycle from the ocean.
Right.
Guess what?
You're as far away from the ocean as you can get.
It's just the dirt version of the ocean, really.
Yeah.
You're not taking a bike to the ocean either, though. I'm going to say that.
It would be a little tough. You'd have to pull the bugs out of your teeth, maybe. But I tell you, you know, I sure love it. I've lived all over the world, and of all the places that I've lived and gone back to, Kansas is the one that we call home.
What? I mean, I know it's a multitude of reasons, but what do you really base it on? What's the main reason?
The people.
Yeah. That's the same thing in Oklahoma. We're both from out of this state. We're not from here originally. We've both been here quite a bit of our life, though, and it is the people that make me, that's what makes me stay.
Absolutely. You know, it's a different kind of thing, they're folks. I mean, they're neighbors.
Yeah.
And so many people, you know, aren't that way in some of the larger cities. And as I said, growing up, I used to walk through 2 miles of farmland to surf. And it was very much that way. And then when it became so crowded, you know, that community neighborhood feeling it's there, but you have to look for it.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, too, and you know, I don't know what it is, but this part of the country, it's the neighborhoods, it's how things are structured,
and it's very unpretentious.
Yes, right.
You know, I mean, the people are willing to you know, sit down and listen to you, and they really want to know how you are. You know, in L.A., when they say, "How you doing?" You know, if you walk up and say, "Hey, how's it going? How you doing?" They give you the resume.
Right. It's how much work you've done. What are you working on right now? Blah, blah, blah. Here they're actually asking, how are you doing? Speaking of which, you had a kind of a rough week last week. What happened?
Well, you know, it was L.A., are you talking about now? Which part are you talking about? The robbery?
Yes, the robbery.
You know, that was pretty interesting. It was my wife's birthday. My wife Malo, who is here, by the way.
Oh, hey Malo, how are you?
So you know, keep it clean.
Yeah, that's right.
You are on the radio, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
You know, it was interesting. I was at my son's house in Hollywood, and he and his girlfriend and Malo and I decided to walk down the street to one of our favorite little restaurants. And the girls were walking ahead of us, and I heard all of this noise, and it just sounded kind of like, you know, one of those drunk guys that you go, okay, you've had a little too much.
Right.
And I turned around, and when I did, there was literally a 45 about 6 inches from my face.
Oh, my Lord.
Whoa.
And the guy was screaming, you know, which one of you mother effers wants to die, you know, and he's pointing the gun back and forth, and the girls were able to kind of keep walking down the street, but he kept putting the gun to my, you know, my son's face and my face. And I just finished doing a new show for VH1, and part of it was being taught Commando Krav Maga, by the guy that invented that style of combat. He teaches the Israeli armed special forces and the U.S. special forces, and it's all about hand-to-hand combat.
Wow.
Okay.
It's important that you say commando Krav Maga, because there are there's people out there just doing Krav Maga, and it's a different thing.
Oh.
And but this guy is the real dude. Like, you look at him, and you know this man's killed people.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And the thing that we learned, spent a lot of time on, oddly enough, was how to disarm a guy that's put a gun to your head.
Sweet!
And the whole time, as soon as I saw the gun, I never got excited. My heart never started racing. I was never nervous. It was weird. You start to think on three or four different levels. My body was reacting and doing the things that they taught me to do. Whenever he would point the gun towards my son, I'd make my way between the gun and my son, and then he started screaming at the women, and I just kind of eased my way in front of the gun there. But as I did so, I'd try to move in closer to where I knew I could take it away from him.
Right.
But it kind of freaked him out, because I wasn't upset.
Right. You weren't freaking out. You weren't panicking. You were.
And every time I'd take a little step in, he'd back up. And he'd keep the distance between him and I, and to the point where, you know, it would have been a bit of a foolish move to try something.
Mayla, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay, let me ask you this as we get to this part of the story. There's a gun. How much time did you have to spend in L.A. where you don't run when you see the gun? You were still walking, he tells the story like. Is that true?
Yeah, actually, I kind of stopped and...
There's a gun!
Run, Mayla, run!
No, I stopped. I really just was like, okay. And I knew, I mean, in about really immediately, Willie stepped in between me and the gun. Because I think initially the guy wanted our purses.
Right.
And,
okay.
Melissa's purses. Willie just stepped right in front of the gun and was very calm and said, hey, man. You know, we don't have anything, you know, leave the girls alone. And I knew immediately that Willie was trying to create space for Melissa and I to. And we just started walking across the street, and the guy was yelling at us. Once we got across the street, I stopped to watch to make sure Willie was going to be all right and opened up my cell phone to dial 911. But, you know, it was just Willie being very, very calm. And yeah, this is about the third time this has happened to me in Los Angeles. So
wow.
I was kind of like, well, yeah, here we go again.
Man,
Willie,
well, and, you know, the other times, if you read our book, you know, Mayla's spent so much time living in on Hollywood Boulevard, she's seen it happen where it didn't work out so well. I mean,
right.
The thing is, I think it freaked the guy out because everybody was pretty nervous, but me, and I kept moving into him, and it. You could just tell that he didn't like that.
Right. Yeah.
And he turned around and he jumped into a car that he had running. And as he backed out, I went to look at the license plate, and he stuck the gun out the window again. And I got most of the license plate, so I think there's a good chance we're going to catch the guy.
Wow.
But,
wow.
You know, it really is an interesting deal. I mean, it just... what you were taught comes in. You're thinking about, you know, gauging the distance between you and the guy, and, you know, every time he'd move the gun to a different person, you know, how to get between those two, and at the same time not rile him up to the point where he might actually pull the trigger.
Right.
I think that sense of being calm really kept him off balance, and he split. So the best thing happened. You know, he got away with very little. Nobody got hurt. And, you know, the only thing we missed out on was dinner.
Well, I know a little later there was something you probably didn't miss out on.
What was that?
Well, you know, you kind of
step up.
You are
the hero.
Yeah, you're a hero, and heroes get rewards, don't they?
Reward, right? Right, Mayla?
Well, let's just say I'm wearing Smiling Bob's smile.
Let's talk about the book once again here real quickly, too, which I love the title, by the way.
Grace.
You know, it's something that I probably wouldn't have chose. Actually, I didn't choose it. I wanted to call the book something else. But our publisher reminded me that as an author, I'm very obscure. And if I would like to remain in obscurity, just keep going with the titles you were coming up with. So I caved, and we went into Grace's Enough.
Well, talk about from where to where this book, it takes us through the whole journey, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it really does. And you know, so many times to us, to be honest with you, I mean, everybody seems to love the book, People Magazine and the LA Times. And you know, all kinds of different people. And it's really shocking to us that, you know, it's to us it's just our story. But it starts at age 8 with me going into the film and television industry, and it starts about the same time for Melo. And what I wanted to do and what I think Melo wanted to do as well was be brutally honest about our lives up until this point, all the way through Bible Man. And I also wanted to allow people to get the sense of what goes on emotionally when you grow up as a child star. Because we hear so much about Lindsay Lohan and Britney, and I didn't want it to be a book about who I slept with and that sort of thing.
Right.
I wanted it to be like, this is what was going on with me emotionally and mentally as I went through all of these different things. And then Melo was doing the same thing, only while I was riding around in limousines and eating at the White House, she was a daily rape victim, ran away and lived in 8 out of trash cans on Hollywood Boulevard. And most likely, when I was getting out of a limousine to go into a premiere, she was in the doorway, you know, of a burnout building on Hollywood.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up in that context, because I want people to understand this is a dark book. Life is dark, and you point out some of the darkness.
It really is. We really wanted to be brutally honest. And in fact, there's many things that we wrote that the publishers just refused to publish because it was too graphic.
It's interesting. We just finished another interview, and the host said, you know, I could not put the book down. I read it in like 2 days and was totally fascinated. And at the same time, there were parts that were so uncomfortable to read.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's sort of like looking at a car wreck. It's
so horrible you can't look away.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, there's some things that are very uncomfortable about it. But in the end, what we really wanted people to see is, even though I came from a position of, you know, making so much money and being in limousines, and Melo came from such a tragic physical abuse, you know, emotional background, that sort of thing, what we found when we got together and we started helping each other put our lives back together was that the pain was the same.
Yeah, you know, I was about to say that too. It's like you two both had a story, a history of loneliness, completely different, but it's still loneliness, and yeah. It's still that, you know, and it was amazing that you two found each other.
It really is, and that was one of the other things that you know, compelled us to write the book, was that it truly is a great love story. I mean, you know, two people that came from such different backgrounds should have never met, and yet we did, and it was because of those backgrounds that we were able to lift each other up.
It's also, like you used the word loneliness, and that's kind of a buzzword for me, because I think a lot of women, even women in great marriages and have great relationships with their kids, and there is a lot of loneliness, even when you're surrounded by people.
Yeah.
We all hurt the same. We all feel victimized at some point by something. We all have things we have to get over, and there's a great deal towards the end of the book about, you know, being able to forgive, not allowing what happened to you define who you are. It happened to you. It's not who you are. You are better than that, and that you can come out of that with a great deal of hope and grace and joy and depth, and you can really have a lot more empathy and compassion for others, and it just actually can be turned into a good thing.
I think the book also speaks to, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, I've been a very public Christian, and so is Melo, but the main thing for us in that respect, I think the guy from the LA Times really said it well. He said he was expecting a book that was all about being evangelical, and that's not what he got. What he got was a book that really was brutally honest, but gave a lot of hope to a lot of people. And our faith is there. It's a component, but that's not what it's all about. And that's really what we wanted, because I'm not really interested in preaching to the choir, and I'm not really interested in making that the focal point of that book. I wanted the focus to be that, look, every one of us needs to extend grace to the other. I've got no right to judge anybody for anything in their lives because I know what I went through. I don't know where people are at. And I've never seen it written in the Bible, and I've studied it lots and lots, where it says, go ye therefore and traumatize the already traumatized in my name.
Wow, you know what? Maybe that's in one of the lost books. But
it really could be, you know. I really have a strong belief in that where, you know, and I'll kind of get serious theologically real quick, but Jesus himself never said anything. He said, I didn't come here to judge anyone or condemn them. That right. wasn't my job. Well, if it wasn't his job, how could it be ours? I just don't get that part of it, you know?
Yeah.
Our only job is to try to be understanding and to love one another and to be there to give them hope. And that's what we wanted the book to accomplish.
Well, we also wanted people to know that we're just, you know, we're goofy. We're real.
Yeah.
Have, you know, issues. I mean, I've had plenty of times where I've wanted to throw my Bible out the window, you know?
Right.
It's not easy. Life is life.
Sure.
I've been in a good marriage. You know, we've been married almost 22 years. It's, you know, you still have to walk through a lot of stuff together.
Yeah.
That's right.
And, you know, that's just, we're all the same. There's a lot in the book, you know, that I think a lot of different people have gone through a lot of the same things that we have.
And unfortunately, whenever she feels like heaving her Bible out the window, I'm usually on the receiving end.
Wow.
Well,
yes.
Willie Mill, it is a great message, and it's a great book. Please pick it up. Grace is Enough, and get it online as well as in your local bookstores. And we appreciate your time.
Well, and
come on down. Have some barbecue down here. I know you got some good barbecue up there.
Well, you know, I was just talking to Tony, and I said, hey, I'm going to be down, and I'm going to help promote a few things down there. So maybe when I come down, we'll give you all a call, and I'll drop in the studio and see if I can't ruin your day.
That sounds perfect.
Please do.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
All right.
We'll see ya.
Bye.
Bye-bye.